Richard Starks and Miriam Murcutt are here. They are both writers and world travelers. Richard has authored 7 books on subjects from travel to economics, and Miriam is a writer, editor, and former marketing executive with extensive experience in the travel and publishing industries. They are here to talk about their new book, A Room with a Pew, that's P-E-W, Sleeping Our Way Through Spain's Ancient Monasteries. Welcome to the program.
Well, nice to be here.
Thank you.
How did you come up with the idea of touring the monasteries of Spain?
I think it all started back in 2005 when Richard and I walked the Camino, El Camino de Santiago, the Way of St. James, from the Pyrenees across northern Spain to Santiago de Compostela. And we walked almost all of the way, not the entire way, to be perfectly honest, but we did a pretty good job, about 350.
Yeah, I think the whole route is about 500 miles, and I think we managed 350,
which I think is a good effort.
A good effort, yeah.
And then along that route, of course, there are scores of monasteries, which were built centuries ago, actually, to accommodate the pilgrims who were walking, you know, the real pilgrims who were walking that route, not the new pilgrims of today. And we did go inside a lot of those monasteries and found them very interesting. And when we were looking for an excuse to go back and visit Spain again, because it's a country we, you know, whose culture and history we very much enjoy, so we were looking for a reason to go back to Spain. And we decided that doing a monastic trip would be a novel experience and a new way of looking at the country of Spain.
Who is your book written for? You did a tour of Spain staying only in monasteries. Is the normal traveler going to be interested in your book?
Well, yes, definitely. I mean, it is written for people who want to go to Spain and as tourists or travelers, and it's designed to give them a novel way of seeing the country. Instead of staying in hotels or guest houses or wherever they might normally stay, it gives them another layer of the unexpected and another layer where they can experience something quite new. So it's very much aimed at people who are planning to go to Spain, have already been there several times and aren't going to go again, or first-time visitors to Spain who are looking for something slightly different.
Generally, how are the accommodations?
Well, they are very clean and very simple. The rooms are usually twin-bedded rooms rather than double rooms. They have basically no frills and very much in line with the Cistercian ideal of enough. You won't often find little free samples of shampoos and soaps and things like this. But what you will find are good standard quality rooms in a wonderfully quiet and different environment.
And I gather the monasteries in Spain are typically in a situation where they're when you're inside, you're kind of a different world, I think, isn't it?
Well, it's definitely very quiet, yes, because we deliberately chose monasteries that are occupied by monks and nuns, or monks or nuns who are actively engaged in a religious community. And so it is very quiet, yes. I mean, there's no vow of silence or anything like that, but they do try and keep as quiet as possible.
So all of the monasteries that you stayed in were active monasteries. They still have an order in residence.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we chose them on that basis. I mean, there are other monasteries you can stay in, which are almost becoming hotels. But the ones we stayed in, we deliberately chose them because they are active religious communities.
Do you have to profess some religious affiliation to be accepted as a traveler in these monasteries?
Well, fortunately, that's not necessary. I mean, obviously, it doesn't hurt at all if you're very religious, but you certainly don't have to be. Monks and nuns have a tendency, they don't proselytize. They never try and change your way of thinking. Their belief is that they are there to honor God, and they don't really mind whether you do or not.
The monasteries in Spain, and I presume in the rest of Europe, what has their function been historically? I mean, welcoming pilgrims has been one function of monasteries, I think. But there's a bigger role, I think, for the monastic system. And I'm sort of wondering what you discovered about that in your visiting these places.
Well, centuries ago, I mean, when we first started, you know, studying Spanish monasteries, we thought they'd probably been built by, you know, benevolent types who were prepared to donate to the church. But in fact, many monasteries were built by noblemen, or the funds for them were supplied by noblemen or kings and queens for fairly selfish reasons.
Such as?
Well, such as they wanted somewhere to hide their illegitimate children, or perhaps they wanted to make sure that in the afterlife there'd be someone there to pray for them. Therefore, if they were kind to monks and nuns, the prayers would float up to heaven and, you know, they would do well in the afterlife. And they were also, to some extent, too, looking for endorsement of their present position on earth. They were there to rule, and with monks and nuns praying for them, that endorsed their position here on earth as well.
So the wealthy really funded the monasteries in Spain, would you say?
Well, to a large extent, yes, because very often, as Miriam says, they gave them, the nobles and the royal members of the royal family donated land to the monasteries. So they did supply a lot of the money that resulted in the monasteries being built. But it was a trade-off. The royals were trying to buy favour with the church. I mean, the church was an extremely powerful organisation. The royals were very keen for the church to endorse their right to rule here on earth.
What other functions have the monasteries performed over the years? I mean, they've maintained religious orders. They've maintained libraries. In some cases, you describe in the book a museum that you visited in one of the monasteries with a collection that was accumulated over some period of time. Are those the primary functions of the monasteries historically?
Well, no, they were there to teach. I mean, in the Royal Monastery at Vibona, they used to take in the nuns there. It's a Cistercian monastery. The nuns there used to take in the daughters of noble families and educate them. They were also there to, you know, to tend the sick. But in the more cloistered orders, the main reason for their existence is to worship God. That is their raison d'etre, to work and to pray.
And that's why you would join a monastery if you wanted to be a nun or a brother or a priest.
That's why you would join the cloistered orders, such as the Benedictines and Cistercians and the Trappists. But some of the other monasteries that we visited housed teaching orders. For example, you mentioned the museums in monasteries. Well, in the monastery of Santo Tomas in Avila, the monks there, well, they actually, technically, they're friars, the Dominican friars, because they have been out in the world teaching, have done a lot of teaching in the Far East. And that's really where the booty, if you like, has come from their museum. It's from their teachings overseas.
So what is the function of these places today, mostly?
Well, it's still very much to honour God. I mean, this is why the monks and nuns are there. I mean, they devote all their time to praying. I mean, they pray seven times a day and spend every day like that in church, or silently praying, or reading religious texts. I mean, that is all they do, basically.
And as a traveler, are you able to partake in some of that ritual if you want to, some of those activities if you want to?
Very definitely. I mean, some monasteries require you to, and they like it if you do. Others, of course, are completely indifferent whether you join in or not.
In fact, with the monastery, the Trappist monastery in Las Escolanias, we participated in all of the monks' prayer services and realised then how arduous a task it is actually to be faithful. Their first service starts at 3 a.m. and that's followed throughout the day by the six other prayer services, and then they also have to fit in a work programme for about 3 a.m. because self-sufficiency is one of the great rules that St. Benedict laid down, that the monastery should be self-sufficient, the community should be self-sufficient. So they have 3 hours of work slotted in the morning as well. So there's it's actually quite a busy life, really.
Quite a regimen.
Well, it's a very big commitment, yeah, there's no question.
Mm-hmm. What was your favourite monastery?
Well,
and you may have different ones, yeah.
Well, that's very difficult to say. I mean, they're all... One thing about monasteries is they all have basically the same layout, and yet each one is a different experience. So in many ways, the favourite one depends on which particular experience you happen to enjoy most. And I particularly liked one in Vibona, which was an extremely old one. It was built at about 1153, I think. And I just was fascinated by the age of the building, and to think that it was 300 years old or so when Gutenberg printed his first Bible, and about 500 years old, I think, when the pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. So, I mean, I
sure,
find that kind of aspect, that just sort of history.
Interesting
that age
to contemplate.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And of course you can then extrapolate into the future, you know, looking back 800 or 900 years, you can think, well, what's going to happen in 800 or 900 years in the future? Will the monastery still be here? The answer is probably yes. Will we be here? Obviously not. So, I mean, it does change your perspective of time as much as anything, and that's one of the elements that I like about staying in that particular monastery.
Did you wonder who had been there before you?
Yes, definitely. I mean, these monasteries, you know, as I say, they've seen a tremendous amount of history. In the one in Avila, we were shown around by one of the friars who took us into the room where St. Teresa used to pray and have her confessions, and he went next door. And Torquemada, the great instigator of the Spanish Inquisition, was buried there for a while until his bones were moved elsewhere. So, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of history that you just come across incidentally, and it's shown to you by monks and friars and nuns who take it for granted. You know, they will show you around and they will wave at a room and just or a piece of furniture and say, oh, this is Renaissance, you know, in the same way that you might say, showing somebody else around your own room that this is an IKEA or something of that nature.
It's part of their life.
Yeah, and they just take it for granted. They've lived there 60 years, some of them, if they're pretty old, and, you know, that's their life.
Miriam, which was your favorite?
Well, I guess I have to favor Las Escalanias, actually. I mean, it was a more modern monastery to the extent it was a converted finca.
Located in which city?
That was near Cordoba. Mm-hmm. It was actually about 7 miles right out in the countryside, which was one of the things that I found enormously appealing about it, mm-hmm. because these monks were practicing their faith surrounded by gorgeous groves of orange trees, walnut trees, fig trees. Brilliant setting. And then the monastery itself was extremely attractive, colonial-style building. And the actual church that they worshipped in had been converted from the cow barn. And it was just a beautiful building. And really getting up at 3 a.m. to go to their early morning church prayer was no hardship. Wonderful sky, beautiful moon, beautiful buildings, and a really very touching service as well.
I think I could have done with 2 more hours in bed.
Yeah.
But still, 3 o'clock in the morning wasn't too bad.
Considering the circumstances.
Yeah.
Well, as a traveler, you would what would the regimen be? You had a rental car, I think. So you were traveling by car. You would travel to a town where a monastery was located. Would you have to have reservations in advance? That seems pretty important, apparently.
Yeah, I think it is. First of all, most of the monasteries we visited weren't in towns, which was the reason really for having the rental car. There are a number of monasteries within city, but not particularly the ones that we chose to visit. Although en route to monasteries, we did drop into some really interesting cities. I mean, our route started in Barcelona and then went right down to Malaga in southern Spain. And so we had the opportunity to go to visit Toledo, Cordoba, Sevilla, as well as, doing our monastic stays.
So these are sort of exotic farmhouse B&Bs, in a sense.
No. I would no. You were asking about the reservation system and things like this. When we actually made our reservation for Las Escalonias, the Trappist monastery I've described, the email came back saying, yes, we're very, very pleased to welcome you, but this is not a hotel. And in larger letters, this is not a hotel.
Oh, really?
And in larger
that was
letters,
emphasized.
This is not a hotel.
Oh.
And that's fair enough. And we did participate in the religious community and got a great deal out of it. On the other hand, Marchena.
So the rules are made known in advance.
You can judge. I wouldn't say you get anything as set as rules, but you can judge from either the monastery's website, because many of them have websites, or from the email correspondence that goes back and forth, exactly what the tenor of the monastery is. And, for example, the Marchena one, which is a monastery of Franciscan Clarissa nuns, their website says, Marchena is beautifully located for visiting the towns of Aceta, Carmona, and a variety of other towns around. So clearly they are, plugging their location.
As a home base for for tourists.
Yes, mm-hmm. Even though they are theoretically a cloistered mm-hmm. order.
So in advance you would know the rate, you would know roughly what was expected of you, you'd know the location. And so would you make a choice based on... And of course, you mentioned in the book that you chose monasteries that were active. You did not want tourist attractions, basically.
That's right.
Yeah. So those are those were those the primary criteria upon which you chose these monasteries in which to stay?
Well, we had a route, first of all, didn't we?
Yes. I mean, there are so many monasteries in Spain.
Is there a large selection?
There are, yeah. I mean, they're mainly in the north, which was the part that was always Christian, or nearly always Christian, rather in the south, which was Muslim for about 800 years. Mm-hmm. But there are monasteries all over the country. So therefore, I think the first thing you do is choose a route that you would like to take through Spain. And you will always be able to find monasteries on the way when and if you want to stay in one. So that was one of the first criteria. But then, as we said, we did want an active religious order. That was another factor that in our consideration.
We also wanted monasteries who would accept. We were traveling as a pair, and we wanted monasteries that would actually accept a man and a woman as a couple. Now, if you were traveling as a female or a male on your own, you would actually have an even wider selection of monasteries.
Was the purpose of your trip primarily to visit and stay at monasteries, or you did a lot of other touring as well with the monasteries as your lodging, I think, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were really interested in focusing on life in the cloister. Mm-hmm. And so the towns we visited was more peripheral stuff. But they're really mentioned in the book, because a lot of people don't want to spend that much time in the monasteries, and there were very, very many beautiful towns around that were within easy striking distance. Mm-hmm. The only thing I would say is that if you're after a wild nightlife, and then probably staying in monasteries is not for you, because they're locked up pretty tight by 10. Mm-hmm. Yes, and there's no good knocking at the door, because no one will hear you. And the walls are too high to climb over.
Yeah. What is the general condition of these monasteries today? I mean, has Rome abandoned the monasteries in Spain in a financial sense?
Well, most of them are poor, or most of the ones we stayed in. There are some, one or two that, there's one in Montserrat, for example, which I think must make a lot of money because it attracts hundreds of thousands of tourists each year. But most of the ones we visited were off the beaten track, and they are fairly poor, and they struggle to make ends meet in a variety of different ways. Obviously taking in paying guests, but also a lot of them take in laundry for local hotels and hospitals. Some of them have gift shops, they make some wine, those sort of things. And they also do get some money from the government if, in fact, their monasteries have been declared buildings of interest, if you like. That are worth preserving by the government.
And it's sort of like a historic register.
Yes, receive some funds in that way.
Yes, I mean, not all of them actually charged a set fee for overnight accommodation. One of them was actually completely free, mm-hmm. On Laura, and you could just give a donation.
Are the prices generally fairly reasonable?
Well, they're a lot more reasonable than, you know, the European hotel, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And a lot of them, a number of them have excellent restaurants as well.
In the monastery.
Yeah. You're as well to check out exactly what the facilities are, because some of them have nothing, and the villages they're in have almost nothing as well. And so we tended to stock up the trunk of our car with some
provisions,
basic food supplies, and a bit of cruz campo and tempranillo to keep us going. So it's as well to have a little, a few backup supplies.
I mean, when we checked into the monastery in Montlaura, the nun who showed us to a room indicated there was a kitchen there that we could use to either cook and eat in. And then after she'd shown us to the room, she said, well, I'll see you downstairs and we can meet in the bar. And I wasn't sure that we'd heard her correctly, but in fact, when we went downstairs, there in fact was a fully stocked bar.
Really?
With a nun sitting at the counter. Yeah. I'd like to say that she was sitting there, knocking back shots of bourbon or whatever, complaining about the state of the world, but that's not the case. But there is a bar there.
The nun was tending bar?
No, she was actually... The bar is tended by
a bartender.
A gypsy from Romania in that particular monastery. So the two of them, when we went down and met them in the bar, were sort of conversing about the bar's business.
Well, you met some interesting characters, apparently, in some of the monasteries. Can you tell us about a couple of them?
Well, there was one nun that we met in El Toboso, who was a member of a cloistered community.
And, Trinitarians, weren't they?
Yeah, Trinitarian, I think it was. And one of the things I found most surprising about her was the fact that she had no idea who the president of Spain was. Nor do I, but I'm not Spanish. But
yeah, don't have a reason to know, I suppose.
Well, but more tellingly, I think she had no. She'd never heard of Barack Obama, for example, and she had no idea who had preceded him as president of the United States. She'd never heard of anything to do with the outside world. But she did show us some of the treasures, as she called them, that were in the museum in the monastery. And there was one in particular that she just pointed at, and it was a painting of Jesus. Which was painted by a Flemish artist. I think he was 17th century. Albert Boots, was it?
Boots, yes.
We later Googled him to find out a bit more about him and found that this particular painting had, was worth, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it was just sort of hanging on the wall in this monastery where it's seen primarily by eight rather elderly nuns and by passing strangers like us.
Was that unusual, or are there many, do you think, hidden
There are a lot
of art treasures in some of the monasteries.
No, there's a lot, definitely. I mean, in the Franciscan monastery, where they'd done a lot of work in the Far East, we were shown a chalice, and the friar was showing us around, you know, sort of said it was the age, it's 5th century, and then he added BC, you know, so that all of a sudden, you know, you realize that you know, you don't really know what you're looking at, or we didn't, I didn't. But in fact, it's worth a tremendous amount of money and is very rare indeed.
Let's talk just a little bit about logistics. If a person wants to do a tour of monasteries or stay in monasteries in Spain, how does a person go about finding information? Of course, your book is certainly a good source. What other sources of information are there if you want to determine where you would stay and what your route might be?
Well, as far as where to stay is concerned, go straight to the internet. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of quite good websites, one called guiasmonasterias.com and another one, surprisingly, called toptourofspain.com, both of which have listings of monasteries, which you can then use that as a source for more information and go to the individual monasteries' websites.
Do most of them have websites?
A lot of them do. Not all of them, but a lot of them
enough
do.
That you could find places to stay.
We certainly found our monasteries through those particular sources.
So we list most of these sources in the book. In fact, there's a chapter at the end of the book which is about how to plan your own trip specifically for people who would like to go to Spain and stay in monasteries.
And if you know, you're not a Spanish speaker, you can still use something like Bing Translator.
I found that useful from time to time.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty crude translation, but it'll certainly
But you get
tell
the
you.
Idea, for
yeah,
sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, just one final question. You're both writers. How does the division of labor go in writing a book like this?
Well, I mean, a book like this, I mean, the first thing you have to do, since it's nonfiction, is you have to go out and get the story. It's not something you sit down and sort of make up in your head. So, I mean, that's a huge part of it, is making the journey and then finding the right monasteries to stay in, because the... I think the success of the book depends to a very large extent on which monasteries you select in the first place.
When you're traveling, do you take notes? Do you take photographs?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you do some recordings?
For us, it's actually very hard work because although we do interview and talk to a lot of monks and nuns, I mean, we do then go back to our cell, if you like, and write up the day's notes and... make sure that we've captured what it is we want to say about that particular monastery.
And then you have to filter all of that in the final writing and editing process when you get back to
Well, yes, and also home, look at, you know, the areas that you would like to expand on, you know, the areas of the history of monasticism or the history of the area you were in or, you know, the Muslim-Christian conflicts in Spain. But this book was very, very much dependent on primary research. We wanted to, you know, get the story from the horse's mouth and actually be there ourselves and have our own interpretation because, you know, we wanted something that was original.
The book is A Room with a Pew, Sleeping Our Way Through Spain's Ancient Monasteries by Richard Starks and Miriam Murcutt. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.